I'm sure, but if he did, it would be very like the Colonel. That had to be it. There was no other explanation. What was it that Father had said when I told him Dogger, too, had overheard his quarrel with Bonepenny? That is what I fear more than anything. His exact words. It was odd, really. Almost ludicrous, like something out of Gilbert and Sullivan. I had tried to take the blame to protect Father. Father was taking the blame to protect Dogger. The question was this. Whom was Dogger protecting? Thank you, Mrs. M, I said. I'll keep our conversation confidential, strictly on the QT. Girl to girl, like, she said, with a horrible smirking leer. The girl to girl was too much. Too chummy. Too belittling. Something in me that was less than noble rose up out of the depths, and I was transformed in the blink of an eye into Flavia the pig-tailed avenger, whose assignment was to throw a wrench into this fearsome and unstoppable pie machine. Yes, I said, girl to girl. And while we're speaking girl to girl, it's probably as good a time as any to tell you that we none of us at Buckshaw really care for custard pie. In fact, we hate it. Oh, Pitt, I know that well enough, she said. You do? I was too taken aback to think of more than two words. Course I do. Cooks know all they say, and I'm no different than the next one. I've known that Deluces and custard don't mix since Miss Harriet was alive. But why do I make 'em? Because Alf fancies a nice custard pie now and again. Miss Harriet used to tell me the Deluces are all lofty rhubarbs and prickly gooseberries, Mrs. M, whereas your Alf's a smooth, sweet custard man. I should like you to bake an occasional custard pie to remind us of our haughty ways, and when we turn up our noses at it, why, you must take it home to your Alf as a sweet apology. And I don't mind saying I've taken home a goodly number of apologies these more than 20 years past. Then you'll not need another, I said. And then I fled. You couldn't see my bottom for dust. Chapter 21. I paused in the hallway, stood perfectly still and listened. Because of its parquet floors and hardwood panelling, Buckshaw transmitted sound as perfectly as if it were the Royal Albert Hall. Even in complete silence, Buckshaw had its own unique silence, a silence I would recognise anywhere. As quietly as I could, I picked up the telephone and gave the cradle a couple of clicks with my finger. "I'd like to place a trunk call to Doddingsley. I'm sorry, I don't have the number, but it's the inn there. The Red Fox, or the Ring and Funnel. I've forgotten its name, but I think it has an R and an F in it." "One moment, please," said the bored but efficient voice at the other end of the crackling line. This shouldn't be too difficult, I thought. Being located across the street from the railway platform, the RF, or whatever it was called, was the closest inn to the station, and Doddingsley, after all, was no metropolis. "The only listings I have are for the Grapes and the Jolly Coachman."
"That's it," I said, "the Jolly Coachman."
The RF must have bubbled up from the sludge at the bottom of my mind. "The number is Doddingsley 23, the voice said, "for future reference."
"Thank you," I mumbled, as the ringing at the other end began its little jig.
"Doddingsley 23, Jolly Coachman. Are you there? Cleaver here." Cleaver, I assumed, was the proprietor.
"Yes, I'd like to speak with Mr. Pemberton, please. It's rather important."
Any barrier, I had learned, even a potential one, was best breached by pretending urgency. "He's not here," said Cleaver. "Oh, dear," I said, laying it on a bit thick. "I'm sorry I missed him. Could you tell me when he left? Perhaps then I'll know what time to expect him." "Flav," I thought, "you ought to be in Parliament."
"He left Saturday morning, 3 days ago."
"Oh, thank you," I breathed throatily, in a voice I hoped would fool the Pope. "You're awfully kind."
I rang off and returned the receiver to its cradle as gently as if it were a newly hatched chick.
"What do you think you're doing?" demanded a muffled voice.
I spun round and there was Feely, a winter scarf wrapped around the bottom part of her face.
"What are you doing?" she repeated. "You know perfectly well you're not to use the instrument."
"What are you doing?" I parried. "Going tobogganing?"
Feely made a grab for me and the scarf fell away to reveal a pair of red, swollen lips, which were the spitting image of a Cameroon mandrill's South Pole. I was too in awe to laugh. The poison ivy I had injected into her lipstick had left her mouth a blistered crater that might have done credit to Mount Popocatepetl. My experiment had succeeded after all. Loud fanfare of trumpets. Unfortunately, I had no time to write it up. My notebook would have to wait. Maximilian, in mustard checks, was perched on the edge of the stone horse trough which lay in the shadow of the market cross, his tiny feet dangling in the air like Humpty Dumpty. He was so small I almost hadn't seen him. "Hello, mon vieux Flavia!" he shouted, and I brought Gladys to a sliding stop at the very toes of his patent leather shoes. Trapped again. I'd better make the best of it. "Hello, Max," I said. "I have a question for you."
"Ho-ho!" he said. "Just like that. A question. No preliminaries. No talk of the sisters. No gossip from the great concert halls of the world."
"Well," I said, a little embarrassed. "I did listen to the Mikado on the wireless."
"And how was it, dynamically speaking? They always have an alarming tendency to shout Gilbert and Sullivan, you know."
"Enlightening," I said.
"Ha-ha! You must tell me in what fashion. Dear Arthur composed some of the most sublime music ever written in this sceptred isle. The Lost Chord, for instance. G and S fascinate me to no end. Did you know that their immortal partnership was shattered by a disagreement about the cost of a carpet?"
I looked closely at him to see if he was pulling my leg, but he seemed in earnest.
"Of course I'm simply dying to pump you about the recent unpleasantness at Buckshaw, Flavia, dear, but I know your lips are thrice sealed by modesty, loyalty, and legality, and not necessarily in that order.
Am I correct?" I nodded my head.
"Your question of the oracle, then?"
"Were you at Grayminster?"
Max tittered like a little yellow bird. "Oh, dear, no. Nowhere quite so grand, I'm afraid. My schooling was on the continent. Paris, to be precise, and not necessarily indoors. My cousin Lombard, though, is an old Grayminsterian. He always speaks highly enough of the place, whenever he's not at the races or playing Oh Hell at Montfort's."
"Has he ever mentioned the head, Dr. Kissing?"
"The stamp waller? Why, dear girl, he seldom speaks of anything else. He idolized the old gentleman, claims old Kissing made him what he is today, which isn't much, but still.
I shouldn't think he's still alive. Dr. Kissing, I mean. He'd be very old, though, wouldn't he? I'm willing to bet everything I have that he's been dead for ages."
"Then you shall lose all your money," said Max with a whoop. "Every blessed penny of it."
Rook's End was tucked into the folds of a cosy bed formed by Squire's Hill and the Jack-o'-lantern, the latter a curious outcropping of the landscape which, from a distance, appeared to be an Iron Age tumulus but, upon approach, proved to be substantially larger and shaped like a skull. I steered Gladys into Pooka's Lane, which ran along its jaw, or eastern edge. At the end of the lane, dense hedges bracketed the entrance to Rook's End. Once past these ragged remnants of an earlier day, the lawn spread off to the east, west, and south, neglected and spiky. In spite of the sun, fingers of mist still floated in the shadows above the unkempt grass. Here and there the broad expanse of lawn was broken by one of those huge, sad beech trees whose massive boles and drooping branches always reminded me of a family of despondent elephants wandering lonely on the African veld. Beneath the beeches, two antique ladies drifted an animated dialogue, as if competing for the role of Lady Macbeth. One was dressed in a diaphanous muslin nightgown and a mob cap which seemed somehow to have escaped the 18th century, while her companion, enveloped in a cyanide blue tent dress, was wearing brass earrings the size of soup plates. The house itself was what is often called romantically a pile. Once the ancestral home of the de Lacy family, from whom Bishop's Lacy took its name, and who was said to be very distantly related to the de Luces, the place had come down in the world in stages, from being the country house of an inventive and successful Huguenot linen merchant to what it was today, a private hospital to which Daffy would instantly have assigned the name Bleak House. I almost wish she were here. two dusty motor cars huddling together in the forecourt testified to the shortage of both staff and visitors. Dumping Gladys beside an ancient monkey puzzle tree, I picked my way up the mossy pitted steps to the front door. A hand-inked sign said, "Ring, please," and I gave the enameled handle a pull. Somewhere inside the place, a hollow clanking, like a cowbell angelus, announced my arrival to persons unknown. When nothing happened, I rang again. Across the lawn, the two old ladies had begun to feign a tea party, with elaborate mincing curtsies, crooked fingers, and invisible cups and saucers. I pressed an ear to the massive door, but other than an undertone, which must have been the sound of the building's breathing, I could hear nothing. I pushed the door open and stepped inside. The first thing that struck me was the smell of the place, a mixture of cabbage, rubber cushions, dishwater, and death. Underlying that, like a ground sheet, was the sharp tang of the disinfectant used to swab the floors. Dimethyl benzyl ammonium chloride, by the smell of it. A faint whiff of bitter almonds, which was uncommonly like that of hydrogen cyanide, the gas that was used to exterminate killers in American gas chambers. The entrance hall was painted a madhouse apple green. Green walls, green woodwork, and green ceilings. The floors were covered with cheap brown linoleum so pitted with gladiatorial gouges that it might have been salvaged from the Roman Colosseum. Whenever I stepped on one of its pustulent brown blisters, the stuff let off a nasty hiss, and I made a mental note to find out if colour can cause nausea. Against the far wall, in a chromium wheelchair, an ancient man sat gazing straight up into the air, mouth agape, as if expecting an imminent miracle to take place somewhere near the ceiling. Off to one side a desk, bare except for a silver bell and a smudged card marked "Ring, please," hinted at some official yet unseen presence. I gave the striker four brisk strokes. At each ting of the bell, the old man blinked violently, but did not take his eyes from the air above his head. Suddenly, as if she had slipped through a secret panel in the woodwork, a wisp of a woman materialized. She wore a white uniform and a blue cap, under which she was busily poking limp strands of damp straw-colored hair with one of her forefingers. She looked as if she had been up to no good, and knew perfectly well that I knew. "Yes," she said, in a thin but busy standard-issue hospital voice. "I've come to see Dr. Kissing," I said. "I'm his great-granddaughter." "Dr. Isaac Kissing?" she asked. "Yes," I said, "Dr. Isaac Kissing. Do you keep more than one?" Without a word, the white phantom turned on her heel and I followed through an archway into a narrow solarium which ran the entire length of the building. Halfway along the gallery, she stopped, pointed a thin finger like the third ghost in Scrooge, and was gone. At the far end of the tall windowed room, in the single ray of sunshine that penetrated the overhanging gloom of the place, an old man sat in a wicker bath chair, a halo of blue smoke rising slowly above his head. In disarray on a small table beside him, a heap of newspapers threatened to slide off onto the floor. He was wrapped in a mouse-coloured dressing gown, like Sherlock Holmes's, except that it was spotted like a leopard with burn holes. Beneath this was visible a rusty black suit and a tall winged celluloid collar of ancient vintage. His long, curling yellow-grey hair was topped with a pillbox smoking cap of plum-coloured velvet, and a lighted cigarette dangled from his lips, its grey ashes drooping like a mummified garden slug.
"Hello, Flavia," he said. "I've been expecting you."
An hour had passed, an hour during which I had come to realize truly, for the first time, what we had lost in the war. We had not got off to a particularly good start, Dr. Kissing and I.
"I must warn you at the outset that I'm not at my best conversing with little girls," he announced.
I bit my lip and kept my mouth shut.
"A boy is content to be made into a civil man by caning, or any one of a number of other stratagems, but a girl, being disqualified by nature, as it were, from such physical brutality, must remain forever something of a terra incognita, don't you think?"
I recognized it as one of those questions which doesn't require an answer. I raised the corners of my lips into what I hoped was a Mona Lisa smile, or at least one that signalled the required civility.
"So you're Jacko's daughter," he said. "You're not a bit like him, you know."
"I'm told I take after my mother, Harriet," I said.
"Ah, yes, Harriet. What a great tragedy that was. How terrible for all of you."
He reached out and touched a magnifying glass that perched precipitously atop the glacier of newspapers at his side. With the same movement, he pried open a tin of Players that lay on the table and selected a fresh cigarette.
"I do my best to keep up with the world as seen through the eyes of these inky scribblers. My own eyes, I must confess, having been fixed on the passing parade for 95 years, are much wearied by what they have seen. Still, I somehow manage to keep informed about such births, deaths, marriages, and convictions as transpire in our shire, and I still subscribe to Punch and Lilliput, of course. You have two sisters, I believe, Ophelia and Daphne."
I confess that such was the case.
"Jacko always had a flair for the exotic, as I recall. I was hardly surprised to read that he had named his first two offspring after a Shakespearean hysteric and a Greek pincushion."
"Sorry?"
"Daphne, shot by Eros with a love-deadening arrow before being transformed by her father into a tree."
"I meant the madwoman," I said. "Ophelia."
"Bonkers," he said, pressing out his cigarette butt in an overflowing ashtray and lighting another. "Wouldn't you agree?"
The eyes that looked out at me from his heavily lined face were as bright and beady as those of any teacher who had ever stood watch at a blackboard, pointer in hand, and I knew that I had succeeded in my plan. I was no longer a little girl. Whereas the mythical Daphne had been transformed into a mere laurel tree, I had become a boy in the lower fourth.
"Not really, sir," I said. "I think Shakespeare meant Ophelia to be a symbol of something, like the herbs and flowers she gathers." "Eh?" he said. "What's that?"
"Symbolic, sir. Ophelia is the innocent victim of a murderous family whose members are all totally self-absorbed. At least that's what I think."
"I see," he said. "Most interesting. Still," he added suddenly, "it was most gratifying to learn that your father retained enough of his Latin to name you Flavia. She of the golden hair."
"Mine is more of a mousy brown."
"Ah."
We seemed to have reached one of those impasses that litter so many conversations with the elderly. I was beginning to think he had fallen asleep with his eyes open.
"Well," he said at last, "you'd better let me have a look at her."
"Sir?" I said.
"My Ulster Avenger. You'd better let me have a look at her. You have brought her along, haven't you?"
"I... yes, sir, but how..."
"Let us deduce," he said, as quietly as if he had said, "Let us pray." "Horace Bonepenny, one-time boy conjurer and long-time fraud artist, turns up dead in the garden of his old school chum, Jacko Deluce. Why? Blackmail is most likely. Therefore, let us suppose blackmail. Within hours, Jacko's daughter is ransacking newspaper archives at Bishop's Lacey, ferreting out reports of the demise of my dear old colleague, Mr. Twining. God rest his soul. How do I know this? I should think it obvious."
"Miss Mountjoy," I said.
"Very good, my dear. Tilda Mountjoy, indeed. My eyes and ears upon the village and its environs for the past quarter century."
"I should have known it. Miss Mountjoy was a spook."
"But let us continue. On the last day of his life, the thief Bonepenny has chosen to take up lodgings at the 13 Drakes. The young fool, well, no longer young, but still a fool for all that, then manages to get himself done in. I remarked once to Mr. Twining that that boy would come to no good end. I hesitate to point out that I was correct in my prognostication. There always was a whiff of sulphur about the lad. But I digress. Shortly after his launch into eternity, Bonepenny's room at the inn is rifled by a maiden fair, whose name I dare not utter aloud, but who now sits demurely before me, fidgeting with something in her pocket, which can hardly be anything other than a certain bit of paper, the shade of Dundee marmalade, upon which is printed the likeness of her late Majesty Queen Victoria, and bearing the check letters T.L., Quod erit demonstrandum, Q.E.D.
Q.E.D., I said, and without a word I pulled the glassine envelope from my pocket and held it out to him. With trembling hands, though whether they trembled from age or excitement I could not be certain, and using the tissue-thin paper as makeshift tweezers, he peeled back the flaps of the envelope with his nicotine-stained fingers. As the orange corners of the Ulster Avengers came into view, I could not help noticing that his nicotine-stained fingertips and the stamps were of a nearly identical hue.
"Great Scott!" he said, visibly shaken. "You found A.A. This stamp belongs to His Majesty, you know. It was stolen from an exhibition in London just weeks ago. It was in all the papers."
He shot me an accusing look over his spectacles, but his gaze was drawn away almost at once to the bright treasures that lay in his hands. He seemed to have forgotten I was in the room.
"Greetings, my old friends," he whispered, as if I weren't there. "It's been far too long a time."
He took up the magnifying glass and examined them closely, one at a time.
"And you, my cherished little T.L., what a tale you could tell."
"Horace Bonepenny had both of them," I volunteered. "I found them in his luggage at the inn."
"You rifled his luggage?"
Dr. Kissing asked, without looking away from the magnifying glass.
"Phew! The constabulary will hardly caper in delight upon the village green when they hear of that. Nor will you, I'll wager."
"I didn't exactly rifle his luggage," I said. "He had hidden the stamps under a travel sticker on the outside of a trunk."
"With which, of course, you just happened to be idly fiddling when out they tumbled into your hands."
"Yes," I said, "that's precisely how it happened."
"Tell me," he said suddenly, swinging round to look me in the eye, "does your father know you're here?"
"No," I said. "Father's been charged with the murder. He's under arrest in Hindley."
"Good Lord! Did he do it?"
"No, but everyone seems to think he did. For a while, even I thought so myself."
"Ah," he said, "and what do you think now?"
"I don't know," I said. "Sometimes I think one thing, and sometimes another. Everything's such a muddle."
"Everything is always a muddle just before it settles in. Tell me this, Flavia. What is it that interests you above all else in the universe? What is your one great passion?"
"Chemistry," I said in less than half a heartbeat.
"Well done," said Dr. Kissing. "I've put that same question to an army of Hottentots in my time, and they always prattle on about this and that. Babble and gush, that's all it is. You, by contrast, have put it in a word."
The wicker creaked horribly as he half-twisted round in his chair to face me. For an awful moment, I thought his spine had crumbled.
"Sodium nitrite," he said. "Doubtless you are acquainted with sodium nitrite."
"Acquainted with it? Sodium nitrite was the antidote for cyanide poisoning, and I knew it in all its various reactions, as well as I know my own name. But how had he known to choose it as an example? Was he psychic?"
"Close your eyes," Dr. Kissing said. "Imagine you are holding in your hand a test tube half filled with a 30% solution of hydrochloric acid. To it, you add a small amount of sodium nitrite. What do you observe?"
"I don't need to close my eyes," I said. "It becomes orange, orange and turbid."
"Excellent. The colour of these wayward postage stamps, is it not? And then?"
"Given time, 20 or 30 minutes, perhaps, it clears."
"It clears. I rest my case."
As if a great weight had been lifted from my shoulders, I grinned a stupid grin.
"You must have been a wizard teacher, sir," I said. "Yes.
So I was, in my day. And now you've brought my little treasure home to me, he said, glancing at the stamps again. This was something I hadn't counted upon, something I hadn't really thought through. I had meant only to discover if the owner of the Ulster Avenger was still alive. After that, I would hand it over to Father, who would surrender it to the police, who would, in due course, see that it was restored to its rightful owner. Dr. Kissing spotted my hesitation at once.
"Let me pose another question," he said. "What if you had come here today and found that I'd hopped the twig, as it were, flown off to my eternal reward?"
"You mean died, sir?"
"That's the word I was fishing for. Died, yes.
I suppose I should have given your stamp to Father."
"To keep?"
"He'd know what to do with it."
"I should think that the best person to decide that is the stamp's owner. Wouldn't you agree?"
I knew that the answer was yes, but I couldn't say it. I knew that, more than anything, I wanted to present the stamp to Father, even though it wasn't mine to give. At the same time, I wanted to give both stamps to Inspector Hewitt. But why?
Dr. Kissing lighted another cigarette and gazed out the window. At length, he plucked one of the stamps from the folder and handed me the other.
"This is AA," he said. "It is not mine, it don't belong to me, as the old song says. Your father may do with it as he wishes. It is not my place to decide."
I took the Ulster Avenger from him and wrapped it carefully in my handkerchief.
"On the other hand, the exquisite little TL is mine. Mine own, without the shadow of a doubt."
"I expect you'll be happy to be sticking it back into your album, sir," I said with resignation, slipping its mate into my pocket.
"My album?"
He gave a croaking laugh that ended in a cough.
"My albums are, as dear dead Dowson put it, gone with the wind."
His old eyes turned towards the window, gazing without seeing at the lawn outside, where the two old ladies still fluttered and pirouetted like exotic butterflies beneath the sun-dappled beeches.
"I have forgot much, Sinara, gone with the wind, flung roses, roses riotously with the throng, dancing to put thy pale lost lilies out of mind, but I was desolate and sick of an old passion, yea, all the time because the dance was long, I have been faithful to thee, Sayonara, in my fashion." "It's from his non sum qualis erum boni sub regno sonare. Perhaps you know it."
I shook my head. "It's very beautiful," I said.
"To remain sequestered in such a place as this," Dr. Kissing said with a broad sweep of his arm, "for all its dowdy decrepitude is, as you will appreciate, a most ruinous financial undertaking."
He looked at me as if he had made a joke. When I offered no response, he pointed to the table.
"Fetch out one of those albums, the uppermost, I think, will do."
I now noticed for the first time that there was a shelf wedged in below the tabletop, upon which were two thick-bound albums. I blew off the dust and handed him the top one.
"No, no, open it yourself."
I opened the book to the first page, which contained two stamps, one black, the other red. By the slight marks of gummy residue and the ruled lines, I could see that the page had once been filled. I turned to the next page. And the next. All that remained of the album was a gutted hulk, a sparse, ravaged thing that even a schoolboy might have hidden away in shame.
"The cost, you see, of housing a beating heart. One disposes of one's life one little square at a time. Not much of it left, is there?"
"But the Ulster Avenger," I said. "Oh, it must be worth a fortune."
"Indeed," said Dr. Kissing, glancing once more through the magnifier at his treasure. "One reads in novels," he said, "of the reprieve that comes when the trap's already sprung, of the horse whose heart stops an inch past the finish line."
He chuckled dryly and pulled out a handkerchief to wipe his eyes.
"Too late
late, too late, the maiden cried, and all that. Curfew shall not ring tonight. How fate loves a jest, he went on in a half-whisper.
Who said that? Cyrano de Bergerac, was it not?
For just a fraction of a second, I thought how much Daffy would enjoy talking to this old gentleman, but only for a fraction of a second, and then I shrugged. With a slightly amused smile, Dr. Kissing removed his cigarette from his mouth and touched its lighted tip to the corner of the Ulster Avenger. I felt as if a ball of fire had been thrown into my face, as if my chest had been bound with barbed wire. I blinked, and then, frozen with horror, watched as the stamp began to smoulder, then burst into a tiny flame which licked slowly, inexorably, across Queen Victoria's youthful face. As the flame reached his fingertips, Dr. Kissing opened his hand and let the dark ashes float to the floor. From beneath the hem of his dressing gown, a polished black shoe ventured out and stepped daintily on the remains, then, with a few quick twists, ground them beneath the toe. In three thunderous heartbeats, the Ulster Avenger was no more than a black smudge on the linoleum of Rook's End.
The stamp in your pocket has just doubled in value, said Dr. Kissing. Guard it well, Flavia. It is now the only one of its kind in the world.
Chapter 22. Whenever I'm out of doors and find myself wanting to have a first-rate think, I fling myself down on my back, throw my arms and legs out so that I look like an asterisk, and gaze at the sky. For the first little while, I'm usually entertained by my floaters, those wormy little strings of protein that swim to and fro across one's field of vision like dark little galaxies. When I'm not in a hurry, I stand on my head to stir them up and then lie back to watch the show, as if it were an animated cinema film. Today, though, I'd had too much on my mind to bother. So when I had bicycled no more than a mile from Rook's End, I threw myself down on the grassy bank and stared up into the summer sky. I could not get out of my mind something that Father had told me, namely that the two of them, he and Horace Bonepenny, had killed Mr. Twining, that they were personally responsible for his death. Had this been no more than one of Father's fantastic ideas, I should have written it off at once. But there was more to it than that. Miss Mountjoy, too, believed they had killed her uncle, and had told me so. It was easy enough to see that Father felt a real sense of guilt. After all, he had been part of the push to view Dr. Kissing's stamp collection, and his one-time friendship with Bonepenny, even though it had cooled, made him an accomplice in a roundabout sort of way. But still... No, there had to be more to it than that. But what it might be, I could not think. I lay on the grass, staring up at the blue vault of heaven as earnestly as those old pillar-squatting fakirs in India used to stare directly into the sun before we civilized them, but I could think of nothing properly. Directly above me, the sun was a great white zero, blazing down upon my empty head. I visualized myself pulling on my mental thinking cap, jamming it down around my ears as I had taught myself to do. It was a tall, conical wizard's model, covered with chemical equations and formulae, a cornucopia of ideas. Still nothing. But wait. Yes, that was it. Father had done nothing. Nothing. He had known, or at least suspected, from the instant it happened that Bonepenny had pinched the head's prize stamp, and yet he had told no one. It was a sin of omission, one of those offences from the ecclesiastical catalogue of crime Feely was always going on about, that seemed to apply to everyone but her. But Father's guilt was a moral thing, and, as such, hardly my cup of tea. Still, there was no denying it. Father had kept silent, and by his silence had perhaps made it seem necessary for the saintly old Mr. Twining to shoulder the blame and pay for the breach of honour with his life. Surely there must have been some talk at the time. The natives in this part of England have never been known for their reticence. Far from it. In the last century, the Hindley Pond poet Herbert Miles had referred to us as that gaggle of geese who gossip gaily upon the gladdening green, and there was a certain amount of truth in his words. People love to talk, especially when the talking involves answering the questions of others, because it makes them feel wanted. In spite of the gravy-stained copy of Inquire Within Upon Everything, which Mrs. Mullet kept on a shelf in the pantry, I had long ago discovered that the best way to obtain answers about anything was to walk up to the closest person and ask. Inquire without. I could not very well question Father about his silence in those schoolboy days. Even if I dared, which I did not, he was shut up in a police cell and likely to stay there. I could not ask Miss Mountjoy, who had slammed a door in my face because she viewed me as the warm flesh and blood of a cold-blooded killer. In short, I was on my own. All day, something had been playing away in the back of my mind like a gramophone in a distant room. If only I could tune into the melody. The odd feeling had begun when I was browsing through the stacks of newspapers in the pit shed behind the library. It was something someone said. But what? Sometimes, trying to catch a fleeting thought can be like trying to catch a bird in the house. You stalk it, tiptoe towards it, make a grab, and the bird is gone, always just beyond your fingertips. Its wings... Yes. Its wings! He looked just like a falling angel, one of the Grayminster boys had said. Toby Lonsdale, I remembered his name now. What a peculiar thing for a boy to say about a plummeting schoolmaster. And Father had compared Mr. Twining, just before he jumped, to a haloed saint in an illuminated manuscript. The problem was that I hadn't searched far enough in the archives. The Hindley Chronicle had stated quite clearly that police investigations into Mr. Twining's death and the theft of Dr. Kissing's stamp were continuing. And what about his obituary? That would have come later, of course. But what did it say? In two shakes of a dead lamb's tail, I was aboard Gladys, pedalling furiously for Bishop's Lacey and Cow Lane. I didn't see the close sign until I was 10 feet from the front door of the library. Of course. Flavia, sometimes you have tapioca for brains. Feely was right about that. Today was Tuesday. The library would not open again until 10 o'clock on Thursday morning. As I walked Gladys slowly towards the river and the pit shed, I thought about those sappy stories they tell on the children's hour, those moral little tales of instruction such as the one about the pony engine. I think I can, I think I can, which was able to pull an entire freight train over the mountain just because it thought it could. It thought it could. And because it never gave up. Never giving up was the key. The key! I had returned the pit shed's key to Miss Mountjoy. I remembered it perfectly. But was there by chance a duplicate? A spare key hidden under a windowsill to be used in the event some forgetful character wandered off on holiday to Blackpool with the original in her pocket. Since Bishop Lacey was not, at least not until a few days ago, a notable hotbed of crime, a concealed key seemed a distinct possibility. I ran my fingers along the lintel above the door, looked under the potted geraniums that lined the walkway, even lifted a couple of suspicious-looking stones. Nothing. I poked in the crevices of the stone wall that ran from the lane up to the door. Still nothing, not a sausage. I cut my hands to a window and peered in at the stacks of crumbling newspapers sleeping in their cradles. So near, and yet so far. I was so exasperated I could spit. And I did. What would Marie-Anne Pauzé Lavoisier have done, I wondered. Would she have stood here fuming and foaming like one of those miniature volcanoes which results when a heap of ammonium dichromate is ignited? Somehow I doubted it. Marie-Anne would forget the chemistry and tackle the door. I gave the doorknob a vicious twist and fell forward into the room. Some fool had been here and left the stupid thing unlocked. I hope no one had been watching. Good thing I thought of that, though, since I realized at once that it would be wise to wheel Gladys inside where she wouldn't be spotted by passing busybodies. Skirting the mouth of the boarded-over pit in the middle of the room, I eased my way gingerly round to the racks of yellowed newspapers. I had no trouble finding the relevant issues of the Hindley Chronicle. Yes, here it was. As I thought it might, Mr. Twining's obituary had appeared on the Friday after the account of his death. Twining, Grenville, M.A., Oxfordshire. Passed away suddenly on Monday last at Grayminster School near Hindley, at the age of 72. He was predeceased by his parents, Marius and Dorothea Twining, of Winchester, Hants. He is survived by a niece, Matilda Mountjoy, of Bishop's Lacey. Mr. Twining was buried from the chapel at Grayminster, where Reverend Canon Blake Soames, rector of St. Tancred's, Bishop's Lacey, and chaplain of Grayminster, led the prayers. Floral tributes were numerous. But where had they buried him? Had his body been returned to Winchester and laid to rest beside his parents? Had he been buried at Grayminster? Somehow I doubted it. It seemed much more likely that I would find his grave in the churchyard of St. Tancred's, no more than a 2-minute walk from where I was standing. I would leave Gladys behind in the pit shed, no point in attracting unnecessary attention. If I crouched down and kept behind the hedgerow that bordered the towpath, I could easily pass from here to the churchyard without being seen. As I opened the door, a dog barked. Mrs. Fairweather, the chairman of the Ladies' Altar Guild, was at the end of the lane with her corgi. I eased the door shut before she or the dog could spot me. I peeked out the corner of the window and watched the dog snuffling at the trunk of an oak as Mrs. Fairweather stared off into the distance, pretending she didn't know what was going on at the other end of the lead. Blast! I'd have to wait until the dog had done its business. I looked around the room. On either side of the door were makeshift bookcases whose rough-cut, sagging boards looked as if they'd been hammered together by a well-meaning but inept amateur carpenter. On the right, generations of outdated reference books, year upon year of Crockford's Clerical Directory, Hazel's Annual, Whittaker's Almanac, Kelly's Directories, Brassey's Naval Annual, all jammed uncomfortably cheek by jowl on shelves of unpainted boards, their once regal bindings of red and blue and black now bleached brown by time and seeping daylight, and all of them smelling of mice. The shelves on the left were filled with rows of identical grey volumes, each with the same gold-leaf title embossed on its spine in elaborate Gothic letters. The Grey Minsterian. I remembered that these were the yearbooks from Father's old school. We even had a few of them at Bupshaw. I pulled one from the shelf before noticing that it was marked 1942. I returned it to its place and ran my index finger to the left along the spines of the remaining volumes. 1930, 1925, here it was, 1920. My hand shook as I took down the book and flipped quickly through it from back to front. Its pages overflowed with articles on cricket, rowing, athletics, scholarships, rugger, photography, and nature study. As far as I could see, there was not a word about the magic circle of the Stamp Society. Scattered throughout were photographs in which row upon row of boys grinned and sometimes grimaced at the eye of the camera. Opposite the title page was a photographic portrait edged in black. In it, a distinguished-looking gentleman in cap and gown perched casually upon the end of a desk, Latin grammar in hand as he gazed at the photographer with a look of ever so slight amusement. Beneath the photo was a caption, Grenville Twining, 1848-1920. That was all. No mention of the events surrounding his death, no eulogy, and no fond recollections of the man. Had there been a conspiracy of silence? There was more to this than met the eye. I began slowly turning pages, scanning the articles and reading the photo captions wherever one was provided. 2/3 of the way through the book my eye caught the name Deluce. The photograph showed 3 boys in shirt sleeves and school caps sitting on a lawn beside a wicker hamper which rested on a blanket littered with what appeared to be food for a picnic. A loaf of bread, a pot of jam, tarts, apples, and jars of ginger beer. The caption read, Omar Khayyam Revisited, Grayminster's Tuck Shop Does Us Proud. Left to right, Haviland de Luce, Horace Bonepenny, and Robert Stanley pose for a tableau from the pages of the Persian poet. There was no doubt that the boy on the left, cross-legged on the blanket, was father, looking more happy and jolly and carefree than I had ever known him to be. In the centre, the long, gangling lad pretending he was about to bite into a sandwich, was Horace Bonepenny. I'd have recognised him even without the caption. In the photograph, his flaming red curls had registered on the film as a ghostly pale aura round his head. I couldn't suppress a shiver as I thought of how he had looked as a corpse. Slightly apart from his comrades, the third boy, judging by the unnatural angle at which he held his head, seemed to be taking pains to show off his best profile. He was darkly handsome and older than the other two, with a hint of the smouldering good looks of a silent movie star. It was odd, but I had the feeling that I had seen that face before. Suddenly, I felt as if someone had dropped a lizard down my neck. Of course I had seen this face, and recently too. The third boy in the photograph was the person who only 2 days ago had introduced himself to me as Frank Pemberton. Frank Pemberton, who had stood with me in Buckshaw Folly in the rain. Frank Pemberton, who this very morning had told me that he was off to view a shroud tomb in Nether Eaton. One by one, the facts assembled themselves, and like Saul, I saw as clearly as if the scales had been ripped from my eyes. Frank Pemberton was Bob Stanley, and Bob Stanley was the third man, so to speak. It was he who had murdered Horace Bonepenny in the cucumber patch at Buckshaw. I'd be willing to stake my life on it. As everything fell into place, my heart pounded as if it were about to burst. There had been something fishy about Pemberton from the outset, and again this was something I had not thought about since Sunday at the Folly. It was something he had said. But what? We had talked about the weather. We had exchanged names. He had admitted that he already knew who I was, that he looked us up in Who's Who. Why would he need to do that when he had known Father for most of his life? Could that have been the lie that set my invisible antennae to twitching? There had been his accent, I remembered. Slight, but still. He had told me about his book, Pemberton's Stately Homes, A Stroll Through Time. Plausible, I suppose. What else had he said? Nothing of any great importance. Some load of twaddle about us being fellow castaways on a desert island. That we should be friends. The bit of tinder that had been smouldering away in the back of my mind burst suddenly into flames. I trust we shall become fast friends. His exact words. But where had I heard them before? Like a ball on a rubber string, my thoughts flew back to a winter's day. Although it had been still early, the trees outside the drawing-room window had gone from yellow to orange to grey, the sky from cobalt blue to black. Mrs. Mullet had brought in a plate of crumpets and drawn the curtains. Feely was sitting on the couch looking at herself in the back of a teaspoon, and Daffy was stretched out across Father's old stuffed chair by the fire. She was reading aloud to us from Penrod, a book she had commandeered from the little shelf of childhood favourites which had been preserved in Harriet's dressing room. Penrod Schofield was 12, a year and some months older than I, but close enough to be of passing interest. To me, Penrod seemed to be Huckleberry Finn dragged forward in time to World War I and set down in some vaguely Midwestern American city. Although the book was full of stables and alleys and high board fences and delivery vans, which were, in those days, still drawn by horses, the whole thing seemed to me as alien as if it had taken place upon the planet Pluto. Feely and I had sat entranced through Daffy's readings of Scaramouche, Treasure Island, and A Tale of Two Cities. But there was something about Penrod which made his world seem as far removed from us in time as the last Ice Age. Feely, who thought of books in terms of musical signatures, said that it was written in the key of C major. Still, as Daffy plodded through its pages, we had laughed once or twice here and there at Penrod's defiance of his parents and authority. But I had wondered at the time what there was about a troublesome boy that had captured the imagination, and possibly the love, of the young Harriet de Luce. Perhaps now I could begin to guess. The most amusing scene, I remembered, had been the one in which Penrod was being introduced to the sanctimonious Reverend Mr. Knosling, who had patted him on the head and said, "I trust we shall become fast friends." This was a kind of condescension with which I lived my life, and I probably laughed too loud. The point, though, was that Penrod was an American book written by an American author. It was not likely as well known here in England as it would have been abroad. Could Pemberton, or Bob Stanley, as I now knew him to be, have come across the book, or the phrase, in England? It was possible, of course, but it seemed unlikely. And hadn't Father told me that Bob Stanley, the same Bob Stanley who was Horace Bonepenny's confederate, had gone to America and set up a shady dealing in postage stamps? Pemberton's slight accent was American. An old grey Minsterian with just a touch of the New World. What an imbecile I had been. Another peek out the window showed me that Mrs. Fairweather was gone and Cow Lane was now empty. I left the book lying open on the table, slipped out the door, and made my way round the back of the pit shed to the river. 100 years ago, the River Efon had been part of a canal system, although there was now little left of it but the towpath. At the foot of Cow Lane were a few rotting remnants of the pilings which had once lined the embankment, but as it flowed towards the church, the river's waters had swollen from their decaying confines to widen in places into broad pools, one of which was at the centre of the low marshy area behind the church of St. Tancred. I scrambled over the rotted lich gate into the churchyard, where the old tombstones leaned crazily like floating buoys in an ocean of grass so long I had to wade through it, as if I were a bather waist-deep at the seaside. The earliest graves, and those of the wealthiest former parishioners, were closest to the church, while back here along the fieldstone wall were those of more recent interments. There was also a vertical stratum. 500 years of constant use had given the churchyard the appearance of a risen loaf, a fat loaf of freshly baked green bread, puffed up considerably above the level of the surrounding ground. I gave a delicious shiver at the thought of the yeasty remains that lay beneath my feet. For a while I browsed aimlessly among the tombstones, reading off the family names that one often heard mentioned in Bishop's Lacey: Coombs, Nesbitt, Barker, Hoare, and Carmichael. Here, with a lamb carved on his stone, was little William, the infant son of Tully Stoker, who, had he lived, would by now have been a man of 30 and older brother to Mary. Little William had died aged 5 months and 4 days of a croup, it said, in the spring of 1919, the year before Mr. Twining had leaped from the clock tower at Grayminster. There was a good chance, then, that the doctor, too, was buried somewhere nearby. For a moment I thought I had found him. A black stone with a pointed pyramidal top had the name Twining crudely cut upon it. But this Twining, on closer inspection, turned out to be an Adolphus who had been lost at sea in 1809. His stone was so remarkably preserved that I couldn't resist the urge to run my fingers over its cool, polished surface. "Sleep well, Adolphus," I said, "wherever you are." Mr. Twining's tombstone, I knew, assuming he had one, and I found it difficult to believe otherwise, would not be one of the weathered sandstone specimens which leaned like jagged brown teeth, nor would it be one of those vast-pillared monuments with drooping chains and funereal wrought-iron fences that mark the plots of Bishop Lacey's wealthiest and most aristocratic families, including any number of departed de Luces. I put my hands on my hips and stood waist-deep in the weeds at the churchyard's perimeter. On the other side of the stone wall was the towpath, and beyond that, the river. It was somewhere back here that Miss Mountjoy had vanished after she had fled the church, immediately after the vicar had asked us to pray for the repose of Horace Bonepenny's soul. But where had she been going? Over the lich gate I climbed once more and on to the towpath. Now I could clearly see the stepping stones that lay spotted among streamers of waterweed just beneath the surface of the slow-flowing river. These wound across the widening pool to a low, muddy bank on the far side, above and beyond which ran a bramble hedge bordering a field which belonged to Malplaquet Farm. I took off my shoes and socks and stepped off onto the first stone. The water was colder than I had expected. My nose was still running slightly and my eyes watering, and the thought crossed my mind that I'd probably die of pneumonia in a day or two, and, before you could say knife, become a permanent resident of St. Tancred's churchyard. Waving my arms like semaphore signals, I made my way carefully across the water and flat-footed it through the mud of the bank. By grasping a handful of long weeds, I was able to pull myself up onto the embankment, a dike of packed earth that rose up between the river and the adjoining field. I sat down to catch my breath and wipe the muck from my feet with a hank of the wild grass which grew in knots along the hedge. Somewhere close by, a yellowhammer was singing "A Little Bit of Bread and No Cheese." It suddenly went silent. I listened, but all I could hear was the distant hum of the countryside, a bagpipe drone of far-off farm machinery. With my shoes and socks back on, I dusted myself off and began walking along the hedgerow, which seemed at first to be an impenetrable tangle of thorns and brambles. Then, just as I was about to turn and retrace my steps, I found it. A narrow cutting in the thicket, no more than a thinning, really. I pushed myself through and came out on the other side of the hedge. A few yards back, in the direction of the church, something stuck up out of the grass. I approached it cautiously, the hair at the nape of my neck prickling in Neanderthal alarm. It was a tombstone, and crudely carved upon it was the name Grenville Twining. On the tilted base of the stone was a single word, Valet. Valet! The word Mr. Twining had shouted from the top of the tower, the word Horace Bonepenny had breathed into my face as he expired. Realization swept over me like a wave. Bonepenny's dying mind had wanted only to confess to Mr. Twining's murder, and fate had granted him only one word with which to do so. In hearing his confession, I had become the only living person who could link the two deaths. Except, perhaps, for Bob Stanley, my Mr. Pemberton. At the thought, a cold shiver ran down my spine. There were no dates given on Mr. Twining's tombstone, almost as if whoever had buried him here had wanted to obliterate his history. Daffy had read us tales in which suicides were buried outside the churchyard or at a crossroads, but I had scarcely believed these to be any more than ecclesiastical old wives' tales. Still, I couldn't help wondering if, like Dracula, Mr. Twining was lying beneath my feet wrapped tightly in his master's cape. But the gown I had found hidden on the tower roof at Anson House, which was now reposing with the police, had not belonged to Mr. Twining. Father had made it clear that Mr. Twining was wearing his gown when he fell. So, too, had Toby Lonsdale, as he told the Hindley Chronicle. Could they both be wrong? Father had admitted, after all, that the sun might have dazzled his eyes. What else had he told me? I remembered his exact words as he described Mr. Twining standing on the parapet. His whole head seemed to be aglow, Father had said. His hair like a disk of beaten copper in the rising sun, like a saint in an illuminated manuscript. And then the rest of the truth rushed in upon me like a wave of nausea. It had been Horace Bonepenny up there on the ramparts, Horace Bonepenny of the flaming red hair, Horace Bonepenny the mimic. Horace Bonepenny, the magician. The whole thing had been a skillfully planned illusion. Miss Mountjoy had been right. He had killed her uncle. He and his confederate, Bob Stanley, must have lured Mr. Twining to the roof of the tower, most likely under the pretense of returning the stolen postage stamp which they had hidden there. Father had told me of Bonepenny's extravagant mathematical calculations. His architectural prowlings would have made him as familiar with the tiles of the tower as he was with his own study. When Mr. Twining had threatened to expose them, they had killed him, probably by bashing his head in with a brick. The fatal blow would have been impossible to detect after such a terrible fall. And then they had staged the suicide, every instant of the thing planned in cold blood. Perhaps they had even rehearsed. It had been Mr. Twining who fell to the cobbles, but Bonepenny who trod the ramparts in the morning sun, and Bonepenny, in a borrowed cap and gown, who had shouted valet to the boys in the quad. Valet, a word that could suggest only suicide. Having done that, he had ducked down behind the parapet just as Stanley dropped the body through the drainage opening in the roof. To a sun-blinded observer on the ground, it would have appeared that the old man had fallen straight through. It was really nothing more than the resurrection of Chang Fu, performed on a larger stage, dazzled eyes and all. How utterly convincing it had been! And for all these years, Father had believed that it was his silence that had caused Mr. Twining to commit suicide, that it was he who was responsible for the old man's death.